DW Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Finally, it is here, the week we've all been waiting for. European Parliament elections are already underway as I record this. To guide us through it all, I'm joined by DW's Jack Parrock.
European politics may look very boring from the outside, but it can be super, super vicious and complex on the inside.
Whoever said European politics was boring? Certainly no listener to this programme. Anyway, more from Jack shortly on everything from Flemish separatists to who's got knives out for Ursula von der Leyen. That's along with the inside story on Brussels' battle against disinformation and a look at the impact of the Gen Z vote and where it's likely to fall. All that, and the first votes aren't even in yet. With over 370 million people across 27 countries electing the 700 politicians who will sit in the world's only directly elected transnational assembly, the European Parliament elections are an audacious and, it has to be said, often highly confusing exercise in parliamentary democracy. Luckily, I was able to persuade DW's Brussels-based elections expert, Jack Parrock, back onto the show to help guide us through. We spoke a little earlier in the week in what may just have been Jack's last minute of quiet before DW's Brussels newsroom entered full-on elections mode, covering not only EU Parliament elections, but federal and regional elections in Belgium as well.
The Belgian election, and actually I'll stake a claim on this, might be the most complex, the most difficult election for the electorate to vote in. You can vote for your commune, for the region in which you live, for the federal parliament, and then the European Parliament elections as well. It's crazy. But really the big story here is what is going to happen in the federal parliament, which runs the country, which provides us with a Belgian prime minister. The way you have to think about this is pretty much two separate national elections in any other country, where you have the French-speaking Wallonian region, which is about 3.5 million people, against the 6.5+ million people in the Dutch/Flemish-speaking region of Flanders. And in that Flemish-speaking region, a massive surge for the far right is expected, which is expected to return Vlaams Belang, a far-right anti-Islam, anti-migration party, to be the biggest party, expected to be about 26 seats of the 150 in the Belgian federal parliament. Now, there's a cordon sanitaire, they call it, against them. So none of the other parties will work with them, which doesn't mean that they're going to provide a prime minister or necessarily be in government, but they are going to use their seats to call for Flemish secession from Belgium, to try and make Flanders an independent state. And the surge towards that election in that region, towards getting them elected, is something that is quite concerning, not only here in Belgium, but also around the European Union. These secessionist movements gaining traction is always a concern for the EU.
Mm. And there's a linguistic link, of course, with Geert Wilders' anti-immigrant party in the Netherlands. And they're very much a sense of the two parties being very keen to work together in the future.
Yeah, I mean, this is what's sort of interesting, especially with these parties, these far-right parties that are claiming they're looking out for the interests of the people in which they represent. They're actually starting to club together now. If you see the French far right, they sort of club together with the Hungarians and the Italian far right, Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni, etc., depending on where they sit, sort of far, hard right, and how that all fits. They're all espousing the same sort of policies, actually. Vlaams Belang has been growing, this far right party in Flanders has been growing for some time. And one of the things that they offer is clarity. This is why they are doing quite well. A lot of analysts that I've spoken to in Belgium, you have so many parties. So depending on whether you're in Flanders or in Wallonia, there's a French Socialist Party or a Flemish Socialist Party, or there is a Wallonian centre-right sort of Christian Democrat Party, or a Flemish centre-right Christian Democrat Party. Same with the Liberals, same with the Greens. There's two parties in this country for all the different political bents. For the Flemish nationalists, they can just be like, this is what we offer. We have something super clear to you, and it's working with voters. We'll see how it pans out when the elections actually happen.
We'll be playing more of my conversation with DW's Jack Parrock later in the show. First, though, here's a quick warning via the European Parliament's official YouTube channel.
Democratic debate is all about lively discussions between people with different opinions. But sometimes the debate is manipulated. An often used tactic is called polarization. It means boosting the most extreme points of views while making all the opinions in between disappear. Stay with me to find out how this kind of manipulation works and why it is a danger to democracy.
Disinformation, always a threat to democracy, but now in an age of AI-generated deepfakes and Russian troll factories, the EU is on high alert. We asked our Brussels-based security correspondent, Terry Schultz, to delve a little deeper for us.
The opportunity to shape the next several years of policy in the 27-country European Union is something no wannabe malign influencer can pass up. The European Parliament being elected now and the European Commission that will be chosen will make critical decisions regarding issues ranging from how much aid arrives in Ukraine to how hard the bloc fights against climate change to the shape of the relationship with China. So the potential wins are particularly big in these elections, but Yanis Sertz of the Riga-based Stratcom Center of Excellence says the attempts to distort the process are nothing new.
Disinformation, one might argue, has always been throughout the history of humans. But for democracy, that is a really, really important area where we have to limit the impact because we want our internal debates, our discussion being based on true views of people and citizens and on facts of the world as it is.
And like disinformation has been present since the birth of democracy, efforts from Moscow in particular, to use it for its own benefit, have long been focused on the European Parliament. That's according to Artis Pabriks, a former Latvian deputy prime minister and European parliamentarian.
Russians have been always using any opportunity and any opening in the West to extend its influence and influence people, influence public views, influence policies. And even if from the first sight, European Parliament doesn't seem to be the most influential legislative body, there is still a lot of people, former prime ministers, former ministers, people who can influence different positions, also looking from the perspective of strategic communication. So it's only logical that Russians are taking interest and trying to push their narrative also through this institution. If I would be a Russian leader, I would definitely do the same.
Russia's estimated annual budget for propaganda and disinformation is 1.5 billion euros per year. Some of that amount has allegedly gone into the pockets of European parliamentarians willing to attempt to polish Moscow's image in Europe. Here's Yanis Sertz again.
They see this as a key battleground and they have no rules in there and they pursue it to reach their goals to create a desirable outcome for Russia and Kremlin in Ukraine and undermine European security.
But you can only blame half of it on the Kremlin. The other side is, of course, the European politicians happy to play along and take the money.
Well, that has been always a problem. It's too easy to do so. And we've been, what I would argue, somewhat complacent and not shining the light on these cases sufficiently.
But one case is getting a lot of attention, with investigations underway in at least five EU countries. A propaganda network set up in Prague called The Voice of Europe, masquerading as a news site, is accused of funneling the cash to EU lawmakers. But Czech authorities shut it down and blacklisted its Russia-backed owners, which the EU subsequently did as well. But it's not just due to pressure from Russia that disinformation is increasing ahead of elections. Plenty of European politicians create their own. In recent weeks, for example, the Hungarian government made up a claim that the EU is planning to force young Europeans to join the military and fight in Ukraine, a complete fabrication aiming to reduce support for the EU among Hungarian voters. Tommaso Canetta from the European Digital Media Observatory, a group of 52 fact-checking organizations, says citizens need to be proactive.
Nourishing a healthy skepticism on one hand, but do not also fall in the exact opposite of not trusting anything or anyone, because this is one of the goals of disinformation, wanting people not to trust anybody and thinking that, you know, truth and falseness are absolutely the same.
Check your sources before you check the boxes. Terry Schultz, DW, Brussels.
Our EU elections coverage continues in just a minute with a look at the race to bag the youth vote and why the EU's top job may not be a shoo-in after all. That's here with me, Kate Laycock, on Inside Europe. First off, let me just make a big shout out to the European Parliament's current crop of interns who have been doing a valiant job generating short social media videos aimed at getting out the youth vote.
Did you know that if you're part of Together.eu, like me, you can get involved on issues that you care about, inspire thousands of people to vote and make a difference for democracy. And make your voice heard on topics like...
If anyone from the European Parliament is listening, give your interns a bigger budget. Seriously though, mobilising the youth vote is seen as key to continuing the upward trend in voter participation witnessed in 2019, which became known as the climate election. This time round, polls suggest that the generational picture is much more complex. More on that later. For now, though, let's join Jesus, Laura, Luis and Jakob, four young professionals who met up with our correspondent Ashish Sharma in a restaurant in Madrid to share their thoughts ahead of the elections.
In terms of, like, the European elections right now, I feel like the media is not talking a lot about it. I also don't see people really talking about it. Like, the candidates only became public a couple of weeks ago. And I got a letter from a party today, like, presenting their candidacy. And in this letter, they don't talk about Europe. They talk about, like, how they can fight the other side of politics, like, the other party. And I don't see proposals on Europe. I don't see how the ambition to improve Europe. I feel like this is, if you go and talk to people, they don't know that the European elections are happening.
National parties think about the European elections in terms of national policies instead of European ones. They think and they propose in national level, and they speak to the public in a very national way instead of the European Union, because the Spanish population are really EU supported, but not really interested in what the European Parliament does or which policies the European Commission proposes for the European Parliament, or even how the European institutions work.
There is a disconnection between the political realm in the EU institutions and the one in the national level. Basically, people tend to not care that much because they don't see even the influence of this European Parliament on real problems, on policies and on daily lives of people itself. Do I have enough money on a monthly basis to pay my rent? Do I have enough, let's say, labor conditions that actually are able to cope my needs, etc.? And that's a crucial question, like, is the EU able to deal the real daily life problems of citizens and to explain how they deal with those?
In Spain, I feel like the European Union is more of a thing we can take advantage of or something we can blame for different reasons. Like, politicians, I feel like sometimes when something doesn't go right, it's the European Union's fault.
European Union cares a lot of topics, sustainability, equality, non-discrimination, health, and all that topics that, of course, they are debating and they are discussing in the European Union.
In the case of my friends, they feel that things that are happening in Brussels are so far from them. So that's why, and I think it's a general attitude or a general feeling in Spanish population, they feel that something that is happening in Brussels, it's so far. Doesn't count for problems that are happening in Spain.
Please vote. Vote for the European elections and read the programs.
Jesus, Laura, Luis and Jakob were talking to our correspondent Ashish Sharma. And as Laura said, if you can, please do vote. Although, do be careful what you vote for. Across the continent, far-right parties are targeting younger voters with slick and savvy social media campaigns, particularly via TikTok. And the polls show that their messages are resonating with a generation struggling to cope with rising rents, inflation, and a general sense that the system is rigged against them. I asked DW's Jack Parrock about the scramble to win the votes of young people, some of whom are very young indeed.
That's right. Yeah. So for a long time, there's been a lot of pressure on the European Union to bring in the youth voice and to be the sort of bastion of young politics. And so far, in a certain number of countries, that's going to happen. This time, in the EU elections, voters from Austria, Belgium, Germany and Malta can be 16 years old, and Greece has lowered the age to 17. As you say, there's a different set of messaging. You connect with those kind of voters in a different way, TikTok being one of the main ones. And what we've seen is far-right politicians very successfully in countries like Italy and France, but also here in Belgium, also in Germany, are using those platforms with very slick campaigns to try and win their votes. Now, in the past, in 2019, in the European elections, we saw a lot of young people in the height of the Fridays for Future and the climate movement vote for the Greens. The Greens did very well. There was the Green Wave last time with a big number of seats in the European Parliament. And they actually kind of took a kingmaker role in supporting the other coalition that worked in the European Parliament. That isn't necessarily expected this time. It's going to be very interesting to see where these new young voters find themselves, where they cast their votes.
I mean, just picking up on that, Jack, those young voters very much were the wind in the sails of the political direction which gave us the European Green Deal. With this expected rightwards shift in the balance of power in the European Parliament, where is the Green Deal? I mean, where are we at with EU climate legislation? Is it all in the balance?
It's certainly under attack. Actually, there is currently right now a farmers' protest going on in Brussels, and there have been many over the last few months, which culminated actually in Ursula von der Leyen, the European Commission president, winding back certain aspects of the climate deal, specifically on this area, which is called the Nature Restoration Law. It's hard to overstate how complex the Green Deal is. There are so many interlayering, overhanging, self-supporting, intertwined different pieces of legislation, which are all aimed essentially at trying to make the EU climate neutral by 2050. And what she did in the wake of the farmers' protest was chip away at some of those deals. For instance, certain obligations on farmers to make sure that some of their land is there to just regrow naturally, so not to be touched. There were some other issues on pesticides, and the EU decided to roll back that. Now, the farmers that are really concerned about this, and also far-right groups that don't really believe in, you know, climate change deniers, etc., have seized on that as a way to try and chip away further. It's part of Ursula von der Leyen's legacy. She really sort of staked her whole claim as a politician on this deal. She's still fighting for it. Also, she will maybe be the Commission president in the next mandate and will presumably try and keep that legacy going.
Right. So let's talk about Ursula von der Leyen, German politician, currently the EU Commission president. That's basically the most powerful job going in the EU. She has been hitting the campaign trail, Jack, in various European countries. Last time I looked, she was in Finland. Why is she doing this? I mean, she's not up for election, as far as I know.
Yeah, this is a very bizarre and peculiar situation that we find ourselves in, where there's kind of a charade of a presidential election, which doesn't actually take place in the way that it would, say, in the United States or France, where you actually vote for the president. So she's on this campaign trail, as are the other leaders from the other political factions. She's representing the centre-right, the EPP group in the European Parliament, but there are socialist and Green lead candidates doing a similar sort of thing. But the voters aren't voting for them. Nobody is going out to cast a vote for Ursula von der Leyen in these elections. Instead, what happens is if her group becomes the biggest group in the European Parliament, then the expectation is that the system will make her European Commission president again. As you mentioned, it's long been seen as pretty much the most powerful job of all of the different EU institutions. What's interesting is in the last 5 years, Ursula von der Leyen has really consecrated that opinion and that position. In fact, international partners that I've spoken to, countries from all around the world, say they see Ursula von der Leyen as the voice of the European Union, not really Charles Michel, who's a Belgian politician who's led the European Council, which is the sort of competitive position to that. Her and him have had many, many battles, and they're famously not speaking to each other, really, unless they have to stand on a stage together. What happens is the 27 leaders of the European governments, so President Emmanuel Macron of France, Olaf Scholz in Germany, for instance, and all the other leaders, they get into a room after the elections take place and they decide who's going to take the top jobs. And this race for the top jobs is done by them, not by the voters of the EU. What von der Leyen has tried to do is to make it look as democratic as possible, to show this big campaign trail that she's doing in trying to get the votes out for the group that she's representing. But when it boils down to it, the voters don't decide. The EU leaders decide whether she will be given that position again.
So in terms of von der Leyen, sorry, this is a bit of a sidetrack, Jack, but I'm fascinated. I mean, is she liked? Are people, you know, going to want to vote for her in that room?
This is a big, big question at the moment. What it appears like is, and there's a lot of reporting at the moment, that the European Council President, Charles Michel, who I just mentioned, has this big battle with her. He will be the guy overseeing and chairing these negotiations.
So it's basically her main arch enemy is going to be chairing the room.
Yeah. European politics may look very boring from the outside, but it can be super, super vicious and complex on the inside. So it could be really difficult. Also, though, the reality is that if the EPP, if the centre-right group get the most seats in the European Parliament, then they will expect the presidency of the European Commission, as we say, probably Europe's most powerful job in the EU institutions. The thing is that the French president, Emmanuel Macron, he's from the liberal grouping. He is known to be considering the former Italian prime minister, Mario Draghi, former president of the European Central Bank, who isn't politically aligned. He's a real technocrat. We know that Macron has sort of been gunning for him to go in there. So there could be other people that can come into the mix. There's some rumours, so I'm reluctant to report them, around different people, an Italian politician who's quite famous, the Croatian prime minister apparently is making a bit of a play for the seat. But the truth is that von der Leyen has a strong claim to stake. She is the lead candidate of the biggest political party we expect to be put in there, and she's done the job for 5 years. If they didn't do it, if they didn't give her the job, if the EPP win the most votes, it will be a huge scandal, and there will be lots of questions asked about how the EU works, what happens. There will be allegations of sexism against a female candidate. It will be really difficult for the EU to sell it if the EPP wins and she doesn't keep her job.
Charles Michel, you have been warned. Our feedback address is insideeurope@dw.com. Our podcast is available on all the usual platforms and comes with bonus content this week, so subscribe if you don't want to miss out. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. Our election special continues this half hour, and we have so many questions. Who's afraid of Giorgia Meloni? Is the European dream of borderless travel coming to an end? Why on earth would Germans with migration backgrounds vote for the AfD? And what's at stake for Ukraine? Stay with us as we delve into those questions and many more besides.
Broadcasting from Germany, this is Inside Europe.
Io sono Giorgia. I'm a mother, an Italian, a Christian, Giorgia Meloni once declared in a now iconic speech on her way to becoming Italy's Prime Minister. Once considered a dangerous outlier in European politics, Meloni, whose political roots are in neo-fascist activism, has so successfully repositioned her Brothers of Italy party that she is now considered one of Europe's most influential political figures and a potential queenmaker following the weekend's elections. From Rome, Megan Williams tells us more.
Her look is more polished, her tone more measured. But the message Italy's leader, Giorgia Meloni, delivered last weekend in a Rome piazza with a crowd of mostly flag-waving men was vintage.
Giorgia!
Giorgia, as she now likes to go by. She lashed out against the left, boasted of blocking migrants, and said that unless people got out to vote for her Brothers of Italy party, they'll be dealing with an EU set on swapping Europe's Christian identity for relativism and Islam. When Meloni stood in this same piazza in 2022, campaigning to become Italy's prime minister, she was a political outsider who had called to bring down the EU from a party with neo-fascist roots with less than 10% in the polls here in Italy. Now, her Brothers of Italy party has the most support in polls here. And to the surprise of many, her role in European politics could be decisive.
She could become pivotal,
says politics professor Lorenzo De Sio of Lewis University in Rome.
Instrumental in having the majority for the new commission. And this is reinforcing that she's not such an outlier anymore.
When Meloni became Italian prime minister, she began working closely with EU head Ursula von der Leyen, cutting deals to curb migrant arrivals. Politics professor at Perugia University for Foreigners, Cecilia Emma Sottilotta, says that as Europe has shifted to the right, Meloni has become a bridge between the center and the fringe.
Because populist and radical right parties are on the rise. So, for instance, look at how Ursula von der Leyen treats Meloni. Meloni is now an interesting broker.
The centre-right von der Leyen, who's running again, is refusing to work with the likes of Hungary's Viktor Orban, Marine Le Pen of France, or Italy's League Party. But she is willing to work with Meloni. And that gives Meloni sway, not just in EU elections, but here in Italy, where she's been quietly implementing an agenda that should have the EU worried, curbing abortion and LGBTQ plus rights, and
trying to limit the independence of prosecutors, trying to limit the independence of the public television. But Meloni has the advantage. She can play much better on the international scene with a staunch support on the Ukraine war and also in the Israel and Gaza question.
At the rally in Rome, this pensioner from nearby Abruzzo says Meloni is not the reactionary many have described her to be, but a moderate who knows right from wrong, clean from corrupt. Supporters like Rachele Medaglia from nearby Naples is here, she says, to support Giorgia, but also in Italy that will be part of the EU with its head held high, she says. To get more votes for her party, Meloni, who won't take a seat in European Parliament if elected, is telling supporters to write Giorgia on the ballot.
We are once again seeing a strengthening of the personalization of politics, and it's all around Meloni, really.
But outside the rally, Italians are showing signs of not buying so much of what she's selling. Her party is still the most popular, but it's been slipping in the polls.
When it comes to European elections, Italian politicians see those elections as an opportunity for visibility. And at the end of the day, an European election is an official, so to speak, opinion poll on how a government is doing.
Which is why, say observers, Meloni is campaigning like it's 2022. Megan Williams, DW, Rome.
Now is the time to unite. That was Marine Le Pen's appeal to Giorgia Meloni, and even just the suggestion of the alliance carries enough power to set Brussels aflutter. This week, as part of our elections coverage, we're offering a special Focus on France bonus episode featuring Fixing France author Nabila Ramdani and two portraits from on the ground, one of Le Pen and her national rally and the other of the people trying to fight it. This episode will be available on our usual podcast feeds, so do check it out and let us know what you think of it. InsideEurope@dw.com. To the AfD now, Germany's far-right alternative party, a party so unashamedly close to the worst chapters of its country's history that last week Marine Le Pen booted it out of the identitarian ID bloc in the European Parliament. Too racist for Marine Le Pen, then, but not necessarily too racist for German voters from migrant backgrounds. That at least is the gamble the AfD is currently trying to pull off as it targets Germany's considerable ethnic minority vote. Just exactly how that works is something our reporter Ben Batke has been looking into.
Berlin is well known for its diversity, but the city's wedding quarter stands out. More than half of its residents have a migration history and less than two-thirds have German citizenship. Election posters for every major party can be found here, with one noticeable exception, the far-right populist Alternative for Germany, or AfD party, which has been consistently campaigning against immigration since its founding in 2013. Yet, the AfD has also been increasingly fishing for the votes of people with a migration history. According to Germany's Federal Statistical Office, last year there were some 3 million people in Germany, or more than 1 in 30, who had Turkish roots.
My name is Nayka Furutan. I am the director of the German Center for Migration and Integration.
Furutan says there are three main ways the AfD is trying to win over voters with Turkish roots.
And they are targeting mainly Turkish voters with the premise that, or with the narrative that they have been fighting together, or Germans and Turkish people have been fighting together already in the First World War, where the Ottoman Empire and the German Empire were partners. And the next point is that they go into this anti-gender narrative. And the third one is that they somehow try to fish Turkish voters by pulling them against new refugees, especially Syrians.
Turks in Germany should vote AfD. They should vote for a party that blocks further immigration, because those who are coming in now are taking housing and jobs away from those who immigrated before and who are not moving up any further now.
Another way the AfD tries to woo immigrants is by including them into their party. One of the most well-known examples is current AfD EU candidate Mary Khan. Her father fled to Germany in the 1970s from his native Pakistan. She disputes that her party is xenophobic.
The AfD is a completely normal democratic party. The remigration issue was misinterpreted. In reality, the concept was primarily about measures and incentives for constitutional repatriation of foreigners who are obliged to leave the country for their countries of origin that are conforming to the law.
According to migration researcher Nayka Furutan, AfD politicians with a migration history can not only reveal how certain migrant communities tick, they can also give the party a non-racist image.
They work as kind of role models because having them, you can think that if she's already part or member of the party, I can vote for them because they accept people like me.
Humboldt University researcher Özgür Özvatan, who specializes in migration, integration, radicalization and social media, says the AfD started reaching out to immigrants on social media last summer.
They tried to reach older generations of immigrants in the first place because they had the feeling that those immigrants were, like, parts of them were upset about the intake of refugees in 2015 and 2016.
Their platform of choice? TikTok, which is especially popular among young people. This matters because the EU elections will be the first time 16 and 17-year-olds can vote, and more than 45% of minors in Germany have a migration history. No other party uses TikTok as skillfully as the AfD. It currently has a 73% market share among political parties in Germany, a figure that doesn't factor in another group that disseminates pro-AfD messages on the social media platform.
Sei doch mal dankbar, hier zu sein, Mann. Du bist ein Gast.
Be grateful to be here. Even if you were born here, you are a guest. I'm not trivializing racism or exclusion, but don't be surprised if more and more people vote for the AfD. How would you like it if somebody came to your country and insulted you?
There is a cosmos of influencers that produce content which is Islam and Muslim friendly. And this is channeled through masculinity. Influencers will say, well, this whole wokeness, it made our women become less traditional.
Migration researcher Naika Forutan believes a growing percentage of voters with a migration history won't make a difference unless Germany's Democratic Party start taking the immigrant factor seriously.
Parties would be well advised if they would go and concretely target immigrants with their specific needs, but actually, because they are all afraid of the AfD, no one is trying to give a program that includes immigrants.
Ben Bartke, DW, Berlin.
Now, remember this?
59-year-old Robert Fietzo was shot as he mingled with the public in the town of Handlovar. Police have charged a 71-year-old man with attempted murder.
This time, 3 weeks ago, we went to air not knowing whether or not Slovakia's populist Prime Minister, Robert Fico, was going to survive the assassination attempt which left him battling for his life after being shot multiple times at close range. Mr. Fico has since been discharged from hospital and is now recuperating at home in Bratislava. But his left populist party, Smer, has not hesitated to capitalise on the shocking event, with several candidates blaming the liberal opposition for the shooting. From Prague, in the neighbouring Czech Republic, Rob Cameron has more.
When it came, it surprised no one. 3 weeks after Robert Fico was gunned down in central Slovakia, he made a full-throated return to political life, releasing a video on Facebook on the eve of the European elections. Mr. Fico, appearing well and dressed in a crisp white and blue patterned shirt, thanked the medical teams who'd fought to save his life in the city of Banská Bystrica and now the capital Bratislava. If all went well, he said, he would be able to return to work at the end of June. But he quickly turned to whom he blamed for the assassination attempt.
It's time to make the first move, and that is forgiveness. I feel no hatred towards the stranger who shot me. I will not take any legal action against him, nor will I seek damages or compensation. I forgive him and let him sort out what he did and why he did it in his own head. In the end, it is evident that he was only a messenger of evil and political hatred, which the political, unsuccessful and frustrated opposition developed in Slovakia to unmanageable proportions.
He went on to warn Slovakia's liberal opposition, the anti-government media, especially those publications controlled by entities linked to George Soros, and foreign-funded NGOs, not to downplay the cause of the attack. This, he said, was the climate of hatred and intolerance created by those who opposed his democratically elected government. Many predicted Robert Fico would return to Slovak politics reinvigorated and vengeful. Speaking before the release of the video, veteran political scientist Grigory Mesežnikov told me from Bratislava he'd expected the atmosphere in Slovak society to be worse.
I mean, I expected the worst situation on the level of society. And fortunately, this atmosphere is more or less normal. You cannot see any indicators of the higher tension between the people, at least in Bratislava. But What really is, from my point of view, is worse relations on political scene. So my expectations were that despite what happened, there were some elements of, maybe not consensus, but more the high understanding about necessity to calm the situation on political scene. And now what I'm witnessing, it's quite the opposite. So even those politicians in the ruling coalition considered as a more moderate, now they are spreading this hatred toward the opposition and indirectly against the supporters of the opposition. And I consider this as quite dangerous.
Robert Fico released his video a few hours before Slovakia's election moratorium, which bans political campaigning until the ballot stations close. But beyond the European Parliament elections, other moves are afoot which could further shake Slovak politics. The General Prosecutor's Office has confirmed it's received requests to ban the main opposition party, the Liberal Progressive Slovakia. It says for now it's examining them. Taking such a step is unlikely, but it's a sign of how far things have gone since Mr. Fico was shot at close quarters and rushed to hospital. For DW, this is Rob Cameron in Prague.
A reminder here that you can listen to all of our election coverage, including a special Focus on France bonus episode, via all the usual podcast apps. Likes, ratings, shares and comments are massively appreciated since they help other listeners to find us. I'm Kate Laycock in Germany. You're listening to Inside Europe. Now, if you were to ask me what I love most about being European, I think my answer would be simple. Borderless travel. Freedom of movement within the majority of EU countries was established by the Schengen Agreement in 1985. My birth year, I am officially as old as Schengen. And for me, the ability to treat Europe as one seamless road trip is something that, at least until the rude awakening of Brexit, I'd always taken for granted. Not so now, though. With nationalist parties expected to make significant gains in the European Parliament, all the old certainties seem up for question. Might the dream of open borders be coming to an end? It was a question that I put to DW's Jack Parrock.
It's a big question, actually. Do you know what? I was driving from Slovakia. I went there to report on the shooting of the Slovakian Prime Minister a few weeks ago. And the airport that serves Bratislava, the capital, is Vienna. And when I was driving back through from Bratislava to Vienna, there was actually some Czechs, some border guards there. And as you say, one of the pinnacles, the prime dreams of the European Union is the border-free Schengen area, free movement. What we started to see, and this actually was COVID that really did this, was border checks go back up and some controls over that. And then what we started to see is the allegations of migration flows as well. This sort of had started back in the, what they call, and I say this in inverted commas, the migration crisis of 2016, when 1 million plus people entered the European Union. There was indications of Schengen border checks coming back up internally within the border-free zone. A lot of the far-right political factions would prefer it. They want to know exactly who's coming in and out of their country. And so there could be pressure on that. We're starting to see they're not necessarily checks. You don't get your passport out, but they sort of drive you into a different lane as you cross the border and just have a look through your car. And there's real questions about what that would mean, because freedom of movement of people is one of the four cornerstones of the European Union. Goods, services, and money as well. And so that's really important to the EU. But it is going to be up for question. And the further the European Parliament swings to the right, which we expect is going to happen, the more pressure there could be on that system.
Oh dear, it is not looking good for my European road trip. Still, there's one country in the EU where the spirit of Schengen has to be alive and kicking. Croatia only joined the free movement agreement last year, so it's got to be enthusiastically behind it, right? Wrong. Already, border checks are back, allegedly temporarily due to the threat of exported terror from the Middle East. Meanwhile, Italy and Austria have likewise imposed border checks on Slovenia. Our Balkans correspondent, Guy Delaunay, pocketed his passport and set out to investigate for us.
It was perhaps the most consequential coffee date in the first decade of Croatia's EU membership. European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen joined Prime Minister Andrej Plenković for a brew in Zagreb's main square on New Year's Day last year. For the first time, payment was possible in euros. What's more, Ms. von der Leyen didn't need to worry about passport checks thanks to Croatia's membership of the Schengen area. It was, she said, a big deal.
This is a day of joy and pride for the Croatian people. It is testimony of your amazing journey, your hard work and your determination.
Prime Minister Plenković was still making a song and dance about it on the campaign trail for the European parliamentary elections. We achieved membership of the Schengen area and achieved membership of the Eurozone, he reminded voters. What he didn't remind them was that Schengen area membership has lost a lot of its sheen since last October. That's when border checks with neighbouring Slovenia resumed, ostensibly over security concerns because of events in the Middle East. It means that frictionless freedom of movement is, once again, off the agenda.
Some people will find the whole Schengen as a cynical gain.
Sven Milicic is a researcher in contemporary Croatian history. He's not impressed with the government's handling of Schengen or the adoption of the euro.
Prime Minister Plenković always advertises, you know, the Schengen and Eurozone. And I think there a lot of people actually don't travel that much, so maybe it won't be as big of a problem. But I think that people are frustrated by the Eurozone. I think that people don't see the point of the whole Eurozone, especially because of the massive inflation that only the introduction of the euro brought, which a lot of people said would happen. And if it happened in Germany, it's realistically it would happen in Croatia as well, and it did. And we all witnessed it.
The European elections come just ahead of the annual rush to the Croatian coast. Tourism contributes more than a fifth of Croatia's GDP. Membership of Schengen and the euro was supposed to ease arrivals and boost that figure even further. But now travellers are bracing themselves for another summer of border queues.
On weekends, there could be 1 hour, 2 hour or even more to wait.
Slovenian architect Matej Granda renovates houses in Croatia. He's aghast to see the return of border checks, and not just because of the time they take.
It's not a positive feeling, because it's a sign that something is really wrong in the whole system. There could be some reasons to do it, but it seems that it's not short-term procedure, it's lasting now, and no one's really taking care of it as a whole. It's a step back instead of really connecting Europe together.
Do you think any of the political parties are offering any solutions at these European elections?
In Slovenia, there is not even a topic in this pre-election debates.
The same goes in Croatia. April's parliamentary elections brought a third successive victory for Andrej Plenković's HDZ, and his party seems confident going into the European polls, perhaps because none of the opposition parties are playing on the Schengen issue. Here in Slovenia, European issues are also glossed over. Instead, the government's trying to boost turnout among their centre-left supporters by holding three referendums on the same day. Perhaps they're hoping a vote in favour of cannabis possession will make voters more mellow about the unwelcome return of border controls. Guy Delaunay, DW, Ljubljana.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure it works like that, Guy. And anyway, this is no week for levity.
At this remove, 8 decades later, it is a near impossible task to imagine the emotion of that day. The pride of being part of so great an enterprise.
Britain's King Charles there, speaking ahead of the 80th anniversary of the D-Day landings. On 6th of June 1944, Allied troops landed on the coast of Normandy in France. Codenamed Operation Neptune, it remains the largest seaborne invasion in history. More importantly, D-Day marked the start of the liberation of Europe from Nazi Germany. This year, the celebrations are overshadowed by the war in Ukraine and by the recent decision of Germany, the US and other countries to allow Ukrainian forces to deploy their weapons against targets within Russia. As European leaders gather in Normandy to remember the dead, I wonder if they're aware of the weight of history on their shoulders.
Yeah, I think so. And especially the politicians from the centrist parties, which we talk all about the far right and the Greens, perhaps. But really, it's important to remember that the majority will be from the centre-right, the centre-left and the Liberals, right? The standard classical parties and the pro-European parties will still have a lot of seats. And when you talk to them, one of the things that they talk to about the defence of Ukraine is that Ukraine is defending European values. As you say, the US and indeed Germany and other countries are now saying that those weapons can be used to fight the Russian invasion. There's a lot of talk in Brussels about how to do this, where to go with the support of Ukraine. They want to continue the support of Ukraine, but there is some fatigue and there's some, whether we like it or not, fatigue amongst voters. And you're not seeing in too many of the member states, in the eastern member states, so the countries that border Ukraine or have close economic ties with them, they're talking about Ukraine. But if you look perhaps in France, even in Germany, the war in Ukraine is not such a massive issue on the minds of European voters, whether the politicians would like that or not. And so there's a sort of middle ground where they're discussing it. And that's where we've seen the Orbans, for instance, sort of campaigning on the end of the war, their claim that they would talk to the Russian President Vladimir Putin. That's not very palatable. But whether Ukraine will be an EU member and get fast-track membership into the European Union, that is the big issue in these potential elections. The enlargement of the European Union to involve Ukraine. Ukraine wants it to happen within the next 5 years. That would be unprecedented. Normally it takes 10 to 12 years for a country starting the process where Ukraine is at right now to get in. So how willing would the next European Parliament be to speed up that process? Ursula von der Leyen's pretty keen, but I think a lot of the EU's member states would be reluctant to move that quickly. But as you say, this is a sort of, it's the weight of history when we look at the D-Day landings, the EU being this project that was born out of the Second World War and all of the horrors that encompassed that period in the late 30s, early 40s. And when the EU started in 1952, and then to the point that we are now, it still is, and that what they still want it to be is fundamentally a peace project. But now the EU's got involved in the sales and purchases of weapons and sending them to Ukraine, it looks very different. The EU coming now will look different going forward. And it's hard really to see how voters from different countries will work that out. And what we'll really see there is how it sort of boils down once we see who actually sits in the European Parliament after the elections.
History remembered and history in the making this week here in Europe. My heartfelt thanks go to DW's Jack Parrock, who has been our guide throughout this election's special edition of the programme. Please do check out our bonus Focus on France edition of the programme. You'll find it wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back next week when the election results will be in. Until then, a quick reminder of our feedback address, insideeurope@dw.com. This programme was produced by Helen Sini with help from me, Kate Laycock, and sound engineer Jan Winkelmann, aided by Bjana Melander. Inside Europe comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany.